This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, a true story of injustice in the American South. Written by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington, with a foreword by John Grisham. Read by Robert Fass. To Kennedy Brewer and LaVon Brooks, and to the memories of Courtney Smith and Christine Jackson. Shame may restrain what law does not prohibit. Seneca. Foreword by John Grisham. It is relatively easy to convict an innocent person. Millions of defendants are processed through our courts each year, so it becomes nearly impossible to determine how many are actually innocent once they've been convicted. No one has the time or resources to examine the facts and backgrounds of those claiming to be wrongfully convicted. Actual wrongful conviction estimates range from 2% to 10%, but no one really knows. These numbers may sound low, but when applied to a prison population of 2.3 million, they become staggering. Can there really be between 46,000 and 230,000 innocent people locked away? Those of us who are involved in innocence work firmly believe so. And, practically speaking, once an innocent person is convicted, it is virtually impossible to get them out of prison. I serve on the board of directors of the Innocence Project in New York. In the past 25 years, we have secured through DNA testing the release of 349 innocent men and women, 20 of whom had been sent to death row. All told, over 2,000 exonerations, including 200 from death row, and including those not involving DNA, have occurred in the United States during that same period. While we are proud of our work, we've only scratched the surface. Wrongful convictions happen for 8 reasons. Not all are neatly defined, and they usually combine with others to produce a bad result. In some of the more egregious cases, the poor defendant unwittingly hit for the cycle and got nailed with all 8. In no particular order of importance, they are bad police work. Most cops are honest, hard-working professionals who aren't paid a high salary. However, there are a not insignificant number of cases in which police officers have hidden, altered, or fabricated evidence, lied on the witness stand, cut deals with snitches in return for bogus testimony, intimidated and threatened witnesses, coerced confessions, or manipulated eyewitness identifications. Prosecutorial misconduct. Most prosecutors are honest, hard-working professionals who aren't paid a high salary, at least not compared to many other lawyers. However, there have been cases in which prosecutors hid exculpatory evidence, encouraged witnesses to commit perjury, lied to jurors, judges, and defense lawyers, used the testimony of bogus experts, or ignored relevant evidence beneficial to the accused. False confessions. Most jurors find it impossible to believe that a suspect would confess to a serious crime he didn't commit. Yet the average citizen, if taken to a basement room and subjected to 10 consecutive hours of abusive interrogation tactics by experienced cops, might be surprised at what they would say under extreme duress. Of the 330 people exonerated by DNA from 1989 to 2015, about 25% gave bogus confessions after lengthy interrogations. Virtually every one recanted soon after. Faulty eyewitness identification. More often than not, those who witness violent acts have trouble accurately recalling the facts and identifying those involved. Yet police regularly use physical and photo lineups, and these are often manipulated in various ways to focus suspicion on favored suspects. Jailhouse snitches. This tactic involves one of the oldest and dirtiest tricks used by police and prosecutors. In every jail, there is a career criminal staring at a long sentence. For leniency, he can be persuaded to lie to the jury and describe in great detail the confession overheard from the accused, usually a cellmate. And if he performs well enough on the stand, the authorities might allow him to walk free. Bad lawyering. Those accused of serious crimes rarely have money. Most are represented by good public defenders, but too many get stuck with court-appointed lawyers with little or no experience. Capital cases are complex, the stakes are enormous, and all too often the defense lawyers are in over their heads. Sleeping judges. Judges are supposed to be impartial referees intent on ensuring fair trials. They should exclude confessions that are inconsistent with the physical evidence and obtained by questionable means, exclude the testimony of career felons with dubious motives, require prosecutors to produce exculpatory evidence, and question the credentials and testimony of all experts outside the presence of the jury. Unfortunately, judges do not always do what they should. The reasons are many and varied, but the fact that many judgeships are elected positions doesn't help. They are conscious of their upcoming re-election and how the decisions they make might affect it. And of those judges who are appointed and not elected, the majority are former prosecutors. Junk science. This is a major reason for wrongful convictions. Over the past 5 decades, our courtrooms have been flooded with an avalanche of unreliable, even atrocious science. Experts of all varieties and with qualifications that were dubious at best and fraudulent at worst have peddled, for a fee of course, all manner of damning theories of guilt based on their alleged scientific analysis of hair, fibers, bite marks, arson, boot prints, blood spatters, and ballistics. Of the 330 people exonerated by DNA tests from 1989 to 2015, 71% were convicted based on forensic testimony, much of which was flawed, unreliable, exaggerated, and sometimes even outright fabricated. University of Virginia law professor Brandon Garrett has studied virtually all of the trial transcripts of wrongful convictions that were later exposed by DNA-based exonerations. He writes, "There is a national epidemic of overstated forensic testimony, with a steady stream of criminal convictions being overturned as the shoddiness of decades worth of physical evidence comes to light. The true scope of the problem is only now coming into focus." This book tells the story of two of the most ambitious and daring experts ever allowed in a courtroom. One was a controversial forensic pathologist who once boasted of performing over 2,000 autopsies in a single year. The other, his sidekick, was a small-town dentist who brazenly and without formal training or study assumed the role of an expert in many other fields, such as ballistics, gunshot reconstruction, tool mark patterns, and the analysis not only of teeth and bite marks, but wound patterns, bruises, and fingernail scratches. Together, they tag-teamed their way through rape and murder trials throughout Mississippi and Louisiana, accumulating an impressive string of convictions, several of which have now been overturned. Some are still being litigated. Many others, sadly, seem destined to stand. This is a maddening story of a broken system, one in which prosecutors allowed, even encouraged, flawed forensic testimony because it was skillfully molded to fit their theories of guilt. Time and again, over 2 decades, elected judges permitted these two men to take the stand and convince unsophisticated jurors that science was on the side of the state. As professional testifiers, they honed their performances and became thoroughly convincing. While breathtaking in its scope, the work these two men did within the justice system is also heartbreaking in its devastation. No one really knows the true extent of the damage. No one knows how many innocent women and men have been convicted in trials in which these two testified, nor is the truth likely to be ever discovered. And it seems nearly impossible to think the state of Mississippi will investigate, audit, or take responsibility. As you listen, you will often be tempted to stop this audiobook and either laugh or cry or yell that what happened in Mississippi cannot possibly be true. But it is. It happened in plain view and with the complicity of many who were sworn to uphold the law. It is my hope that this book might inspire those with the necessary will and persistence to finally bring justice for the men and women around the country who have been wrongfully convicted, and to fix the system so that nothing like this can ever happen again. P.S. In the spirit of full disclosure, I am compelled to accept my share of the responsibility. As an elected member of the Mississippi Legislature back in the 1980s, I remember the struggle to establish and fund the Office of the State Medical Examiner. It was a thorny issue that wouldn't go away, but it was far from the most pressing matters we faced each year. I have no idea how I voted on the various bills, but I do remember being embarrassed by our antiquated system of elected coroners. I recall being frustrated by the state's inability to find and keep a medical examiner. Its failure to do so was a major reason some of the characters in this story were allowed to amass so much power. Author's note. The two of us came to this story separately, each after looking into a different case in which we found expert forensic testimony that seemed odd, outside the boundaries of sound science. Then we found other cases with similarly troubling testimony. And then, many, many others. It soon became clear that this wasn't about one case or even several. It was a sprawling, complex affair that spanned decades, that was rooted in history, politics, and law. The story you're about to hear took place largely in Mississippi and Louisiana, but the component parts, dubious forensics, innocence, the intersection of science and law, and the structural racism built into the criminal justice system, are issues that find their way into just about every courtroom in America. A note from Radley Balco. I first traveled to Mississippi in 2005 to report on the case of Corey May, a tragic story about overzealous policing and the drug war, a subject that would later become the focus of my first book. While investigating that case, I stumbled onto this much bigger story, one that covers two decades and thousands of trials, several of them death penalty cases. Corey May had been convicted the previous year for killing Ron Jones, a Prentice, Mississippi police officer, during a drug raid. May, who was home with his young daughter when the 12:30 a.m. raid went down, claimed he mistook the cops who broke down his door for criminal intruders. The raid on May certainly seemed to have been a mistake. May lived with his girlfriend and daughter on one side of a duplex. On the other side lived a man named Jamie Smith, who was already facing drug charges. Smith's name was on the warrant. May's wasn't, though his address was. The police found a significant quantity of drugs in Smith's home. Corey May had no prior criminal record, didn't know his neighbor, and had no significant quantity of drugs in his home. The police found a single burnt marijuana cigarette in the apartment, which would otherwise have merited a $50 fine. But May had just killed a cop. He was black, the cop was white. And this wasn't just any cop. Ron Jones was also the son of the town's police chief. May was arrested and charged with capital murder. Medical examiner Stephen Hain performed the autopsy on Jones and later testified at May's trial. Hain's testimony was problematic. Based on Hain's testimony about the trajectory the bullet took through Jones's body, the prosecutor argued to the jury that May must have been standing when he shot Jones, not lying on the floor in fear, as he had said he was. The claim made it appear as though May had been lying in wait to ambush Jones. In truth, a number of variables can affect a bullet's trajectory through a body, most notably the victim's position when shot. Moreover, bullets found in the doorframe of May's home had a clear upward trajectory. A bullet's path through a stationary object like a doorframe was a much more likely indication of May's position than its path through a moving human being. Given that May's guilt or innocence hinged on whether the jury believed him when he said he didn't know Jones was a police officer, the doubt prosecutors cast on May's story by way of Hain's testimony was critical. Hain wasn't outright wrong in May's case, He was just slippery. He never came right out and said that May could only have been standing. Instead, he carefully worded his answers, allowing the prosecutor to weave the testimony into the state's closing argument for the jury, all while retaining plausible deniability. May was convicted and sentenced to death. He was later given a new trial when the Mississippi Supreme Court ruled that he should have been permitted to argue that he was defending his daughter's life on the night of the raid. In 2011, after 10 years behind bars, he accepted a plea bargain in which he pleaded guilty to manslaughter. He has since been released. Given the way prosecutors were able to use Haynes' testimony to mislead jurors during May's trial, I began to wonder if they had also done so in others. So I asked around. I first spoke with May's attorney and public defender, Bob Evans, who recalled the case of Tanya Ward, a woman whose skeletonized remains had been found in a wooded area and had been picked at by animals. Haynes testified she had died from strangulation, an improbable diagnosis when there's no soft tissue on the body to examine and no way to tell if any trauma done to her body had come before or after her death. Other attorneys across Mississippi had similar stories. I called other medical examiners across the South, and then police officials and other forensic analysts. On a couple of occasions, I had barely finished explaining that I was working on a story about a questionable medical examiner before the source would interrupt and ask if I was referring to Haynes. Many wouldn't talk on the record, citing Haynes' reputation for litigiousness. But some did. Ken Winter, former head of the Mississippi Association of Chiefs of Police, told me that he was most troubled by the sheer quantity of autopsies Haynes performed, which he called way too many to do in the manner they should be done. One former state official in Mississippi recalled being pressured by district attorneys to change his opinion based on Haynes' analysis, and he could think of two specific murder cases in which Haynes' opinion was way outside the purview of a forensic pathologist. The official was also aghast at Haynes' sloppy practices. "There were frequently test tubes sent to the lab with the wrong name on them," he said. "I reached a point where we just collected all the trace evidence at the scene." Former Columbus, Mississippi Police Chief J.D. Sanders also had stories. Sanders wrote a weekly column in the local newspaper. After a series of columns in which he criticized Haynes and the death investigation system, he received a flood of feedback, both public and private, from coroners and prosecutors across the state. The anger, virulence, and even death threats in some of the responses convinced Sanders that things were worse than he imagined. "There's no question in my mind that there are innocent people doing time at Parchment Penitentiary due to the testimony of Dr. Haynes," Sanders told me. "There may even be some on death row." In October 2007, I published an investigation of Haynes in Reason magazine, along with an accompanying essay in the Wall Street Journal. After the story ran, a local TV station confronted Haynes outside his office about the articles. He promised to sue both me and the Wall Street Journal. The reporter then asked Haynes if he was board certified in forensic pathology. He said he was. When pressed about what organization had certified him, Haynes replied that he couldn't remember. In the 10 years since, I've written dozens of stories about Haynes. I also began writing about Haynes' sidekick, Michael West, the dentist, bite mark analyst, and, in my view, a person who should not have been allowed in a courtroom. The two men dominated the Mississippi death investigation system for 20 years. West testified in dozens of cases, Haynes in thousands. Until and unless the state engages in a thorough top-down investigation of their work, we may never know the extent of the damage they may have done. So far, the people with the power to initiate such an investigation haven't shown much interest. A note from Tucker Carrington. In 2007, I was hired to found and direct the Mississippi Innocence Project, based at the University of Mississippi Law School in Oxford. I packed up my family and office in Washington, D.C., and moved to North Mississippi. On my first day at work, I read through some opinions handed down the week before by the Mississippi Supreme Court. I was startled by the first case I saw. Not only had the state's expert witness given what I considered to be unfounded forensic testimony, the trial court had admitted it in a way that seemed fairly routine. The expert, Stephen Hayne. The defendant was convicted, and the Mississippi Supreme Court affirmed. One of my first tasks as director of a new entity at the law school was to let people know we existed, and to announce our upcoming inaugural fundraiser. The event featured John Grisham, who with his family had provided some of the funding for the new venture, and fellow novelist Scott Turow. We sent a mailer to lawyers, politicians, law enforcement officials, and other prominent figures across the state. After a few days, the responses started pouring in, and it was clear that my staff and I had our work cut out for us. Lawrence Mellon, the district attorney for several counties in the northwest corner of the Delta, wrote back for proof of my claim, which by then was common knowledge for anyone working in the criminal justice system, that DNA evidence had exonerated more than 200 people. Somehow that fact, combined with the establishment of the project, meant that many prosecutors across the state, who were graduates of the University of Mississippi School of Law, were naturally concerned that the law school is impugning our integrity. District Attorney Jim Powell wrote a letter, too. He noted that over the course of America's 230-year history, and among its population of 300 million, there is a claim of only 200 wrongful convictions. Where is the problem? Powell wondered. He also suggested that instead of an innocence project, the law school should start a "The Guilty Bastard Got Off Scot-Free" project. To the extent that these two prosecutors' views were indicative of others, Mississippi's top law enforcement officials seemed unwilling to consider the possibility that Mississippi's justice system might occasionally convict an innocent man. Within a year, they'd be proven wrong, though hardly chastened. Over the next decade or so, as we continued our respective work in journalism and law, Haynes and West's names and deeds kept showing up. Occasionally our work on these cases would overlap, and we'd find ourselves in conversation about new revelations, old cases, and the state's perpetual obstinacy. It finally occurred to us that only a book could give this story the full airing it deserved. This book is driven by the stories of Kennedy Brewer and Levon Brooks, two men in eastern Mississippi. Their trials took place in the 1990s, an era that saw soaring violent crime and, in response, increasingly strident law and order rhetoric from politicians, pop culture, and the media. In the 15 years that preceded Kennedy Brewer's arrest, violent crime in the United States increased by 80%. John DiIulio, the director of George H.W. Bush's White House faith-based initiatives, warned that society risked becoming infested with super-predators, young amoral killers emerging from the youngest, biggest, and baddest generation any society has ever known. In response, lawmakers lengthened prison sentences with mandatory minimums and swelled the ranks of police officers on the streets. In some urban areas, governors called out the National Guard. Politicians rushed to outdo one another with ever more draconian crime policy. Most importantly for this story, the doctrine of habeas corpus, the mechanism by which prisoners can seek relief from unlawful detention that dates back to the Magna Carta, was rewritten in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, making it much more difficult for convicted prisoners to gain relief for erroneous convictions. Mississippi did not distinguish itself. Or it did, but not well. Governor Kirk Fordyce pledged at the time to make the state the capital of capital punishment. The state's largest newspaper ran regular editorials lamenting the fact that drawn-out appeals were preventing officials from executing more people more quickly. Politicians, columnists, and tough-on-crime activists pushed to expand the death penalty to include rape, child abuse, and drug dealing. This was the climate in which Kennedy Brewer and Levon Brooks were convicted. But the full context for this story goes back much earlier than the 1990s. Since Reconstruction, Mississippi has executed 809 people, not including extrajudicial lynchings. Of those executed under law, 642 were black. Most were hanged, though the state now kills with lethal injection, as does most of the rest of the country. Noxubee County, where Brewer and Brooks lived, were arrested and were tried, housed its gallows in the now defunct county jail. It has since been converted into the county library. The gallows trap door is still there, as is the garrote hook, right next to the genealogy section. Before getting to the Brooks and Brewer cases, though, we'll delve into the historical context that made their stories possible. For decades, white Southerners fought integration and tried to preserve white supremacy with racial violence, most notoriously through lynching. Mississippi's death investigation system evolved into a powerful tool to help cover up those atrocities. By most counts, the state led the country in lynchings. Over and over again, elected coroners deliberately covered up racial violence by convening a coroner's jury of like-minded men who would inevitably conclude that obvious murders had been, in fact, accidental killings, suicides, or natural deaths. When a coroner's jury did occasionally determine that a lynching had been a homicide, little to no effort was made to ascertain the identity of the killers or to bring them to justice. When lynching became less common, the system that aided and abetted it still remained. Though some states moved on from the coroner system, others, including Mississippi, allowed it to persist. As a new era of public officials assumed power, they used the system for their own ends, to rack up convictions, to manipulate the court system, or simply to make a lot of money. By the mid-1990s, it even became politically advantageous for some state officials to reinvestigate cold civil rights murders and to try to bring racist perpetrators of decades-old crimes to justice. Here, too, the death investigation system proved useful. Stephen Hain testified in a few such cases. The point here is not that every official in Mississippi's criminal justice and its death investigation systems was or is motivated by bigotry. Hain, for example, not only assisted prosecutors in those old civil rights cases, but was also married for a short time to a black detective. Nevertheless, the system in which he, Michael West, and the state's coroners operated was built on racism, and the new victims still tended to be disproportionately poor and black, with the effects, though better concealed, just as pernicious. This badly flawed Mississippi death investigation system was then infused with another problem that has more recently received national attention, dubious forensics. Since the late 1980s, DNA analysis has exonerated hundreds of innocent prisoners. It has also revealed the extent to which unsound forensic science and improper claims about legitimate forensic disciplines played a major role in those cases. But exonerations resulting from DNA testing provide only a limited glimpse of the problem. Just 5 to 10% of criminal cases involve biological evidence that can be subjected to DNA testing. In the other 90 to 95% of cases, DNA doesn't exist, has degraded, or has been lost. But the same unscientific forensic disciplines used in the cases overturned by DNA testing have undoubtedly also tainted non-DNA cases, and probably at about the same rate. We like to think that our system of justice is unmatched in its guarantees of fairness. Our democracy is too strong, our courts too fair, our prosecutors and judges too conscientious to allow innocents to rot away in prison or be executed. Judge Learned Hand wrote as much in 1923. Our dangers do not lie in too little tenderness to the accused. Our procedure has always been haunted by the ghost of the innocent man convicted. It is an unreal dream. That sort of resolute confidence in American justice persisted through the 1990s. For many, it still persists today. To date, the U.S. Supreme Court has denied 30 petitions for certiorari filed by prisoners later shown to be factually innocent. Many of them were victims of faulty forensic science. The record of lower courts around the nation is worse. The primary antagonists in this story are Stephen Hain, the state's former de facto medical examiner, and Michael West, a prolific forensic dentist. A third is the state of Mississippi itself, not its people, but its institutions. In a larger sense, blame also rests on the courts, both state and federal, the media, and the professional organizations that not only failed to prevent this catastrophe, but did very little even after it was clear that something was terribly wrong. Hain in particular has maintained that he was merely a bit player in all of this, a hard-working doctor who did what he was asked and had no control over the design of a system decades in the making. That argument plays down the active role he played in preserving the system at various points in this story, but there is at least some truth to it. Certainly no one would accuse Hain of laziness. He testified all over the state and typically worked 7 days a week, often until the wee hours of the morning. It's also true that if Hain and West hadn't been the central figures in this story, the system and its misplaced incentives would have produced other figures just like them. Indeed, before Hain's tenure, it already had. Most of Hain's autopsy reports were uncontroversial, as was most of his court testimony. And a large majority of people his testimony helped put away were undoubtedly guilty. Moreover, anyone who did the number of autopsies Hain did was bound to make some mistakes. A defender of Hain might argue that it's unfair to focus on his mistakes instead of his entire body of work. But that argument is both a defense of Hain and an indictment of him. As you continue listening, it's important to remember that this story didn't happen by accident. It happened by design. No one forced him to take on the number of autopsies he did. The death investigation system in Mississippi is designed to allow coroners, prosecutors, and law enforcement officials to use their favored medical examiners. Hain didn't have to be the doctor whom Mississippi DAs and coroners favored for nearly two decades. He emerged as their favorite because of his work product. And for that, he is certainly open to scrutiny. Michael West is a different story. As a longtime associate of Hain, he was aided and abetted by trial courts throughout the state that seemed more interested in ensuring the admission of his novel and often crucial forensic testimony in criminal prosecutions than they did in rigorously assessing the bases of his claims. For his part, West took advantage of the opportunity, and then some. Lawyers for Brooks and Brewer have argued that Hain and West's acts over this period of time were intentional. Recently, a federal appeals court opinion found that while they were mistaken, there was no evidence of an intent to fabricate evidence. It's not our intent, and frankly it would be nearly impossible, to prove whether they acted intentionally or not. But that isn't the point. The point is that courts allowed such unscientific testimony in the first place, regardless of intent. A few administrative notes. For the last decade or so, each of us has worked not only on but within this story. As the narrative progressed, both of us eventually became a part of it. For clarity and ease of listening, we have avoided the first person in these passages. And because we both have written so extensively about these cases and issues, portions of the book have been adapted from prior publications. This book also relies heavily on interviews and thousands of pages of source documents, court transcripts, letters, memos, case reports, dozens of books, and newspaper and magazine articles. Between us, we've interviewed over 200 people. Because of the litigious nature of some of the figures involved, not all of our sources wanted to be identified by name. We've tried to rely on named sources when we can, but that isn't always possible. Because of Tucker Carrington's work as a lawyer, he is or was legal counsel in several cases mentioned in this book, including those of Brooks and Brewer. Finally, while this book is a work of journalism, we obviously have strong opinions about what happened in Mississippi and what needs to happen now. Our opinions and analyses, and at times our outrage, appear throughout the book. We hope that expressing our views will not only contextualize the narrative for the listener, but also help bring about badly needed reform. Kennedy Brewer and LaVon Brooks were felled by seriously flawed forensics, an anachronistic medico-legal system built on structural racism, and a criminal justice system dependent on both. They were failed by the bar, the media, the state appeals courts, the federal courts, the medical profession, and the field of forensics. But they aren't the only ones. As of this writing, countless people convicted with testimony from Stephen Hayne and Michael West still sit in Mississippi prisons. An untold number of murder victims and their families haven't yet received justice because the wrong person was convicted while the culprit remained free, or a homicide victim was misclassified as a natural death, an accident, or a suicide. While West testified in a range of cases that could safely be called dozens, Hayne testified in thousands, around 80% of Mississippi's homicide cases over the better part of two decades. So far, Mississippi officials have only addressed this calamity one case at a time. Others, in particular federal courts, have skirted the issue by invoking procedural bars to avoid entangling themselves in the facts. The result is a staunch refusal to conduct a systematic review of the thousands of cases potentially affected. Doing so would expose the ugly scaffolding that has propped up the system for decades. It would reveal the deep cracks that run to the very foundations of the state's courthouses. But that's exactly what needs to happen. Chapter 1. The Murder of Courtney Smith. Our society has a high degree of confidence in its criminal trials, in no small part because the Constitution offers unparalleled protections against convicting the innocent. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Saturday, September 15th, 1990. LeVon Brooks was dressed and nearly ready when the two McCoy brothers pulled up and honked outside his trailer in Macon, Mississippi. Brooks checked his modest afro in the mirror one last time. He pondered his new mutton chops. He was still trying to decide if he'd actually keep them, and then paused to put a small gold earring in his left ear. In a place like Noxubee County, where dressed up could mean putting on freshly laundered camouflage, Brooks was something of a fashion maven. Impatient with their friends primping, the McCoys honked a second time. They were anxious to get to their job. All three men worked at the Santa Barbara Club, a popular night spot a few miles down the road. It was a great gig for young, single men like them. It paid well, particularly for rural Mississippi, and they got to meet women while they worked. Brooks loved his job. It was tailor-made for his personality. Those who knew Brooks at the time described him as charming, effervescent, and optimistic. Women found him sweet, playful, and easy on the eyes. He'd had a lot of girlfriends, and plenty of ex-girlfriends, and somehow managed to remain on good terms with nearly all of them. Brooks spent much of his spare time hunting and fishing in Noxubee County's pine forests, hardwood coverts, and isolated ponds. His time outdoors kept him lean and toned. Though 32 years old, at 6'1" and 180 pounds, he weighed the same as he did in high school. Brooks had been working at the Santa Barbara since before it opened for business. During the day, he worked as a custodian at the elementary and middle schools in Macon. He had to give up his weekend nights to work at the club, but it wasn't much of a sacrifice. He was getting paid to have fun. The hours were long, but the job was never boring, and it gave him free access to the biggest party in town. The Santa Barbara sat a few miles off of Highway 45, about 20 minutes from Macon. The early 90s were the club's heyday. Old-school blues musicians, such as Willie King from nearby Prairie Point, still played at the older, more established juke joints like Betty's Place, a shingle-sided shack farther out in the country. But what the Santa Barbara lacked in authenticity, it made up for in accessibility, size, and a regular enough schedule that it advertised on local radio. On weekend nights, 200 or 300 people would pack themselves between the building's aluminum sides. Brooks knew almost all of them, if not as a friend, at least by face. He began most nights at the door, a garrulous, welcoming presence as customers lined up to pay the cover charge. Over the course of the night, he'd move to monitor the dance floor or the parking lot. At the end of the night, his favorite time, he'd put on his chef's hat and cook up a feast of fried, artery-clogging food for patrons who stuck around. He'd sometimes sell fish and chicken sandwiches until 2 or 3 in the morning. Eager to get to work that evening, Brooks stepped out of the trailer, skipped down the small set of porch steps 2 at a time, and trotted toward the truck. Just as Brooks hopped up to get in, one of the brothers gunned the engine on the late-model cream-and-brown Silverado, leaving the fashionable and effervescent LeVon Brooks lying face down in his own front yard. The McCoys howled with laughter. Brooks took the prank in stride. He bounced up, dramatically slowed up for a moment, and postured for his friends. He could take a joke. He then broke into a jog, hit the rolling truck on a run, and climbed inside. The Santa Barbara provided the three men a variety of marketable skills and a semi-steady income. On that particular evening, the job Brooks loved so much should have provided one other benefit, a rock-solid alibi. But he'd soon cross paths with Stephen Hayne and Michael West. Even an alibi wouldn't save him. Back in the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration described Brooksville, Mississippi, as a quiet old prairie town of old-fashioned homes softened by an even spread of shade. Shops lined both sides of the main street back then. There was a grand hotel in town, the 3-story Jackson, complete with an ornate lobby and a fancy restaurant. The Mobile and Ohio Railroad ran through town. Residents could take the train 75 miles north to Tupelo to shop, or on fall weekends travel a few miles up the line to West Point, and from there take a spur line to Starkville to watch the Mississippi State Bulldogs play football. Today, what's left of Brooksville sits disconsolate and mostly abandoned. The hotel is long gone, as are nearly all of the old homes and stores. The streets, including Main Street, are bordered by empty storefronts. Appropriately, a lonely Confederate statue stands guard over the railroad tracks that segregate the town. Cross the tracks, and the road fans out into a series of unpaved graveled lanes that lead to Brooksville's black neighborhoods. Most of the homes are single-story, with 1 or 2 bedrooms, sometimes clustered several to a lot. Often a single extended family will occupy multiple homes on the same lot. Locals refer to this as the back of Brooksville. In one of those houses, a single-story blue clapboard cottage, 3-year-old Courtney Smith lived with her mother, grandmother, 2 sisters, and 4 uncles. Courtney and her sister Ashley had spent most of that Saturday with their grandmother Ruby and their great-grandmother Viola. At about 7 in the evening, after a supper of hot dogs, watermelon, and rice with tomatoes, they walked back to their house on Phillips Loop Road. As the evening darkened to night, Sonia Smith bathed her 3 daughters. She dried Courtney off and dressed her in a faded T-shirt with a duck on the front, and the word Mississippi scrawled across the top. Afterward, Sonia went out for the evening, leaving the girls with her mother, Ruby, and her own brother, Tony. As the girls fell asleep, Ruby sat out on the porch for a couple of hours, chatting with friends as they passed by. Tony had been working construction all day and had fallen asleep on the couch while watching football. Eventually, a man Ruby had been dating dropped by with some friends and invited her out. She agreed. On her way, she stopped by a neighbor's house where her other son William, 22, was playing cards. She told him Tony was asleep and asked him to come back to the house in case one of the girls woke up. William agreed, but played several more hands of cards before returning home. As Ruby left at around 11, Tony was the only adult now at the house, still fast asleep on the couch. He wouldn't wake up until late the following morning. The girls slept in the adjacent bedroom. The only light in the house flickered from the television. The demons were whispering to Justin Johnson again. It was a late summer evening in Brooksville, warm, sticky, and calm. Johnson typically drank and smoked when he'd start to hear the voices. He usually smoked pot, but also crack if he could find it. Sometimes it helped keep the voices at bay. Sometimes it only made them louder. Johnson would later tell state investigators that he had always known something wasn't quite right about himself. At the age of 5, he had walked into the kitchen and saw his little brother grabbing for a pot of boiling water. Johnson reached out for his brother's arm, but it slipped through his fingertips. Johnson's brother fell into the stove. The pot tipped over, covering him in scalding hot water. Johnson watched as the boy's skin blistered and separated from his body. The little boy held on for a month before passing away. The incident was Johnson's most salient early memory. He would later say it felt like as if he had watched it all happen from a distance, like watching a movie. He'd replay it countless times in his head in the years that followed. Those around Johnson described him much the way he saw himself. He was slightly off. He was a tad under 6 feet tall and heavy set. He was usually called by his nickname, Joe Kitty. Neighbors and acquaintances would say he had strange eyes. Even when he was standing in front of you, they'd say, he never seemed to be present. He always seemed to be in the background. He was tolerated, never really invited, but often around, hovering on the periphery. It would be another 20 years before a prison doctor would diagnose him with schizophrenia and mild mental retardation. Noxubee County law enforcement officials knew the 33-year-old Johnson as a drug user and a sex offender. In fact, it had been just a few weeks since the last time the voices had told Johnson to hurt someone. On August 29th, he broke into the home of an elderly woman named Millie Lee Wilborn and attempted to rape her. Wilborn fended him off long enough to call the police. He fled. But Wilborn's description left little doubt about who had attacked her. Johnson found himself in the Noxubee County Jail just a few hours later. The charges were serious. Mississippi locks up more of its citizens per capita than any state but Louisiana. A sex offense can carry a life sentence. Johnson's court-appointed lawyer was Robert Prather, a local attorney who tended to get some of the more serious indigent cases. Prather told Johnson he'd work to get him a favorable plea offer, and he came through. The prosecutor agreed to reduce the charge to a misdemeanor on the condition that Johnson consent to counseling. Johnson accepted the offer. As he'd later tell it, on that night, the night of September 15th, the voices told Johnson to visit another woman he knew on Phillips Loop Road. They told him to break into her home and attack her, just as he had tried to attack Millie Wilborn. He tried, but the door was locked. He tried to force it open. He couldn't get in. Johnson looked around. It was night now. He saw a dim, gently bouncing light coming from the small house across the street. He walked over and jiggled the door handle. The door opened, and he went inside. He walked right by a man sleeping on the couch and entered the first bedroom. There on the floor, he saw 3-year-old Courtney Smith fast asleep. He picked her up, cradled her in his arms, and walked out. It was that easy. Johnson carried the girl down a short path between two houses to a hill that overlooked a pond and laid her on the ground. He would later say that this is when the voices told him to teach her. He penetrated her vagina with a finger. Courtney awoke and began to cry. The voices then told him to quiet her. In his confession, Johnson claimed he didn't recall choking the girl, but it seems clear that he did. Courtney Smith's neck showed clear indications of strangulation. The voices finally told him to get rid of her. According to his own recollection, some 2 decades later, Johnson picked her up, took her over a small hill, and threw her into the shallow pond. He then stood and watched as she struggled to stay afloat. Soon Courtney's head slipped under the water, and she disappeared. Johnson then walked back to his car, climbed in, and drove away. By the time William Smith came home between 2 and 2:30 a.m., Courtney was already gone. He saw his brother Tony asleep on the couch in front of a television now broadcasting static. He glanced into the girl's bedroom and noticed something amiss, but didn't make much of it. Looking back, he said it probably occurred to him at the time that Courtney was missing, but he added that if that had even registered with him, I thought she was with her ma, her mama or something. William flipped the television to one of the few channels still airing programming and collapsed onto the other couch. Soon he was asleep as well. The night moseyed toward morning. The McCoy brothers left the Santa Barbara Club before LaVon Brooks finished work for the night, so T.C. Phillips, one of the club's owners, offered to give Brooks a lift home. It was between 2:30 and 3 a.m. when Phillips drove Brooks back south to his house in Macon. At the same time, Justin Johnson headed in the opposite direction to his home in Crawford, a small town a few miles north of Macon. The two cars may well have passed one another that night somewhere along Highway 45. By all rights, that's as close as LaVon Brooks and Justin Johnson should have ever gotten. Two men living two very different lives, passing on a rural highway in the early hours of a warm Mississippi morning. Instead, their lives became hopelessly and inextricably entwined. Sunday, September 16th. After Sonia Smith left the house Saturday night, she eventually ended up at the Santa Barbara Club, arriving a little before 11. Brooks, an old boyfriend of hers, was working the door. Sonia stayed for the rest of the night, leaving at around 2:30 with a new beau. She saw Brooks in the parking lot as she left. When she awoke the next morning, Sonia went to the home of her grandmother, Viola Davis. Sonia's oldest daughter, Ashley, later came by and told her that Courtney wasn't at home. But Ashley had a habit of telling stories. "Quit playing," Sonia admonished. Ashley demurred. "Yeah, she's at home," she said. "She's still asleep." But she wasn't. Sonia's mother, Ruby, had also returned home early Sunday morning. When she didn't see Courtney in the house, she, like Tony, just assumed that the little girl was with Sonia. In fact, everyone thought Courtney was with someone else. It wasn't until 7 o'clock on Sunday evening, when Sonia finally returned home, that the family realized for the first time that Courtney wasn't with any of the family. She was missing. They notified nearby friends and relatives. No one had seen her. Soon they fanned out over the neighborhood, calling out Courtney's name. About an hour later, they alerted police. Brooksville Police Chief Cecil Russell, a white chief in a town that's 80% black, received the first call at around 8 that evening. Within a few hours, hundreds of people joined in the search. At around 1 a.m. on Monday morning, Russell, who had assumed responsibility for the search, asked everyone to go home and get some rest. They'd resume at first light. On the night of Courtney Smith's abduction, Russell never went home. After suspending the search, he continued to look for the girl himself. Exhausted, he eventually returned to his squad car and fell asleep. Monday, September 17th. It was Russell who found Courtney's body a little after dawn on Monday morning. At first, he thought the object a few yards out in the pond was just a trash bag. But as he focused and moved closer, it began to assume the shape of a small child's body. Russell walked down the embankment and eased himself into the water. He floated Courtney to the edge, pulled her up from the pond, and laid her body on the ground. Another police officer had arrived and stood by. Through the thin stand of trees, the two officers could hear car doors opening and light chatter as volunteers began gathering to resume the search. Russell asked the officer for his jacket. He knelt down and wrapped it around the girl's body. Deputy Ernest Eichelberger arrived a short time later. Eichelberger, a stocky black officer, had been with the Noxubee County Sheriff's Office for 3 years and in law enforcement a little over 5. Despite his relative lack of experience, he had recently been promoted to chief deputy. He'd previously been a police chief for the tiny town of Terry, population 1,100. Eichelberger looked at the little girl's body. Other than the officer's jacket, she was clad only in the duck T-shirt. She was bleeding from her head and groin. The sheriff's department would soon take over the investigation. Tales of corrupt Southern police and prosecutors from the bigoted good old boy mold are plentiful and well documented. Less cliched, but no less damaging, are the inept cops, the well-meaning but badly trained and poorly educated rural sheriffs, police chiefs, and their deputies, who rise through the ranks because few others want the job. They're the products of substandard training. They tend to work for departments that are underfunded and neglected by state officials, and they serve poor and vulnerable communities. Few who are familiar with the Courtney Smith investigation ever doubted that Eichelberger wanted to solve the girl's murder. He wanted to get the right man. It just isn't clear that at this point in his career, he had the necessary experience for the assignment. He had only been working at the sheriff's department for about 6 months. Down the sides of his reports, he sometimes wrote out acronyms from police training manuals that he used to conduct a proper investigation. On his report for Courtney Smith's death, he wrote, "ADAPT. Arrest the perpetrator if possible. Detail and identify witness at the scene. Assess the crime scene. Protect the crime scene. Take notes." Eichelberger began his investigation by getting a positive identification of Courtney Smith's body from her father, Rocky Allen. He then turned her body over to Noxubee County Coroner Willie Willie, his real name. Willie then sent the body to be autopsied by Stephen Hain, the state's go-to medical examiner. That night, Hain determined that the girl had been choked, but likely died of freshwater drowning. He found a large bruise on the top of her head. Her hymen had been torn, and she had lacerations on the inside of her vagina, which he'd later say were consistent with penetration from a finger or penis. Hain found no semen and no pubic hair. The girl had been sexually assaulted, but it was unlikely that her killer had forced intercourse. The lack of pubic hair and semen would normally have made it more difficult to definitively identify Courtney Smith's perpetrator. But Hain also found a few bruises on the back of Courtney's right wrist that he suspected, but was not sure, were human bite marks. Later, after the skin had been excised, he examined it under a microscope, and because it showed no signs of bleeding, concluded that the marks were likely made at the time of death or shortly thereafter. He also found some marks on the girl that he thought might be animal bites. Hain then called in his frequent collaborator, Michael West, a Hattiesburg clinical dentist, bite mark expert, and forensic jack-of-all-trades. West drove up the following morning to examine the marks. Unfortunately, someone forgot to tell morgue owner Jimmy Roberts and his staff that West was en route, because they embalmed Courtney Smith's body that same night. Ordinarily, that would have made any sort of bite mark analysis extremely difficult, if not impossible. But Michael West was no ordinary bite mark analyst. Tuesday, September 18th. On Tuesday morning, West conducted a preliminary examination of the girl's body. He agreed that the marks on her wrist had been made by human teeth. He excised the skin around several of them. When a section of skin is cut from the body, it typically retracts and then shrinks as it loses moisture. Because of this, when forensic pathologists excise a section of skin for analysis, they first apply a retainer to preserve the skin's shape. Bite mark analysts claim they can find intricate details and unique indicators within bite marks that can be used to identify or exclude suspects. If the alleged bite mark is distorted when the tissue that contains it is cut away, those indicators will warp, change, or shrivel with the skin on which they're recorded. Some might disappear entirely. Michael West did not use a retainer when he extracted the skin from Courtney Smith's wrist. This should have been a red flag. The fact that Courtney's body had already been embalmed when West conducted his examination should have been another one. Autopsies are almost always done before embalming because the process of pushing blood out of the body and replacing it with embalming fluid causes significant physiological changes. West would later claim at trial that embalming can actually preserve the skin. He was correct in a manner of speaking. The process forestalls the decaying process for a viewing or a funeral. But it does not preserve the sort of details useful to a forensic examiner. It distorts them. West would suggest that,